So here we come to
the final moments for Jesus. He is famously crucified between two criminals, is how the ESV translates it. It's a tricky, at least it's not using the word thief, because they weren't thieves. Who would go through the time and expense of crucifying somebody if they stole things? Nobody. That's inefficient. What the word actually suggests, laestes, is that they were, to use an old-time word, like brigand, bandit, something like that. And this was a known phenomenon around this time, around the time of Jesus, maybe 50, 100 years before and after. Depending on your perspective, they would either be kind of freedom fighters or they would be terrorists. Those are often the same. It just kind of depends on whose perspective you're looking at. These guys most likely would have been violent. Could be like an insurrectionist of sorts, which is what Barabbas was. And it's interesting that one of them mocks Jesus. And the other seems to understand a little bit more that they're getting what they're doing. I found myself kind of going through this, interested in the groups of people and the individuals who either mock or who are sympathetic to Jesus. The leaders that, and they really would be the chief priests, they're the ones with the political leverage to get something like this done, they mock him, like, if he's supposed to be the Messiah, then he should save himself, which is very, very interesting, because the idea of the Messiah saving was a pretty narrow understanding of who the Messiah would be. There was some disagreement. And the Messiah really was supposed to save them from Rome and then reestablish and make holy the temple again. So there's some irony there that it's the temple leadership saying this. How much of that Luke is just sort of writing it down, and how much of it is he trying to point to something? I don't know. But they clearly fall into they mock Jesus category. Then the soldiers who are actually doing the grunt work of crucifying these guys, they obviously mock. I mean, it's bored soldiers. What are they going to do? And I say I've known plenty of soldiers. It kind of also tells us that their work is mostly done. They do their part and then just wait for him to die. But I think we can safely categorize them as mocking. Except for the centurion, who seems to get it. The other gospel writers say a little bit more, like surely he was the son of a god, which is close. and he vanishes from the story, except later Christian tradition saw that moment of the centurion having this, who would have overseen, by the way, this whole process, having this moment of, this was an innocent guy, and they really dug into it, and their imaginations really ran wild. But it's weird here in Luke that he's saying, surely this man was innocent, because I got to be honest, like, typically Rome did not care if they got an innocent guy crucified. Kind of like if you want to make an omelet, you got to break a couple of eggs, and by that I mean crucify a few innocent people. The only time that it would matter is if that person was a Roman citizen. And then we've got a really big problem. There's on record of that happening at least once. But like him saying this man was innocent, under normal conditions wouldn't have the same impact, but something has him keyed into the fact that Jesus was something else. Now, later tradition would name him Longinus, and there's all kinds of things. Just Google it. You'll find all kinds of things that people do, like basically medieval monks when they have too much time on their hands. But nonetheless, he's not in the mocking category. He's kind of a two-bit hero. And then there's the people that really, really got this whole thing started in terms of thinking about, you know, the groups that mock and the groups that seem sympathetic. And that's everybody else. We don't know exactly where the place of the skull is. I'm sure if you went to Jerusalem and the price was right, they would show you the true place. We just don't know. But it certainly would have been in a public place because this was meant to be a spectacle. It's meant to be seen. It's Rome flexing. This was a busy time for Jerusalem because of the Passover, which is starting that night. So there would have been a lot of foot traffic. And they stop and they watch. And Luke says specifically that they came to see the spectacle. They had been watching the spectacle. And in Greek, it's theoria. It's a very interesting word. A lot of times with words, there's a range of meaning. You know, words can mean different things in different times. Just off the top of my head, the word plant. Like, is that something that grows or like a big building that makes things? You got to figure it out. This word, not so much. And it only occurs once in the New Testament, but in other Greek writing, it refers to like the games. Like, you know, Gladiator, Russell Crowe, and Pedro Pascal now, I guess. I haven't seen that one yet. You don't stand and watch a spectacle because you're really sympathetic with the person at the center of it. You stand and gawk, basically. It's like if, where we used to live in Redwood City, California, our intersection was the intersection. I saw so many cars totaled there, and every time you hear the crash, well, you got to go out and look. It's kind of like that. And then somehow in the process, when he finally dies, they're beating their chest. I guess that's, I don't know if it's remorse or grief or sadness or all of the above, but it seems like there's a change that happens there. They go from, well, we should probably see what's going on. Wow, look at that. It's three guys who are bloody and naked and slowly dying. And then he says, Father, I commit my spirit to you, and then dies. And then things just change. There's no way to know what's in their minds. Exactly, anyway. We can just kind of guess based on general human behavior. It seems like with that transition of, there's a spectacle to beating their chests as they're going home, it started as a good idea, and it turns out it was a really bad idea. I know normally I like to look at really big picture stuff. That's kind of who I am. But a lot of this stuff is probably going to get talked about on Good Friday, so I've got to save something for Friday. And so here I just want to narrow in on that idea. Like, it seemed like a good idea at the time. And it turns out it was not. I was trying to think of some things from, like, my own life, my own experience that seemed like a good idea at the time and was not. And I kind of got to those teenage years, and there's just way too many, like this weird go-kart thing from spare parts in the garage that had no brakes and no steering on a really steep hill. Somehow we didn't die. We should have. But history is filled with things that seemed like a good idea at the time. The early 1900s, there was this really cool glowing material that you could put on clocks and wristwatches, and in paint, it was radioactive. That was a good idea at the time. Turns out it wasn't. Or in the Victorian era, as some of you may know, kids can be hard to deal with, and so they would give them laudanum, a mixture of alcohol and opium, to calm them down. It worked. Like, let's just be clear. Like, yeah, it was Mother's miracle. It calmed them right down. As also turns out, it was a really, really, really bad idea. History is filled with these. I wasn't really cognizant of the world at the time, but New Coke was apparently a good idea for a moment. And I'm using these examples to kind of skirt around the heart of the issue. Because the heart of the issue is really uncomfortable. Because there is a really good example, but it's hard. I'm sure many of you here are familiar with at least the idea or the term of the Little Rock Nine, the early integration of the schools in Arkansas. There's a very famous photo, and I think we have it. Yes, we do. You probably have seen this photo. It's Hazel Massery screaming at Elizabeth Eckford. I bet that seemed like a good idea at the time. If she was able to really think about it. I did a little more digging and then a little more digging after the first service at noon. There was some attempt at reconciliation. I think it was complicated, really complicated. Because real reconciliation means you've got to really come to terms with what may have seemed like a good idea at the time. And that is not always easy. You can take that photo down so I'm not staring at it right here. thanks. And the reason why I see a parallel there is that moment in time, in the early stages of school integration, were filled with so much hate. And it's very shockingly easy to get caught up in that. Humans are pack animals. We're more than that. Yes, that's not a theological statement. Don't come at me for that. We are made in the image of God and all of those things. But we also function as pack animals. We like a herd. And what better way to unify a herd than to have that one over there as kind of the common enemy? Or that spectacle over there. Wow, those three guys are having a hard day as they're slowly dying. It's easy, and honestly, it comes quite naturally to human beings to find some kind of unifying enemy, real or imagined, that we could make a spectacle out of and pile on. It's pretty easy to do that here in Christ Lutheran. The answer is obvious. It's Packers fans. There's enough of you to alienate. But there's more of us who don't care. I only say that because I don't follow it. I know we have a part owner here, but and I thought to warn you, Al. But that joke only works because you know what I mean. And I think as we go through these stories, where there's a pretty clear line between whom we would identify as the good guys and the bad guys, there's a couple of figures who are a little more complicated. But we go through these stories, you know, it's pretty clear that the chief priests, they're not the good guys. That centurion, he might be. The people that Luke says traveled with Jesus, even from Galilee, probably the good guys. And boy, do they get a surprise a couple days later. The mistake is, again, assuming that a different heart beats in their chest from ours. It's easy for us to say, well, if I were there at that time, I would have known that that was Jesus, the Son of God, the real Messiah, come to take away the sins of the world and defeat death. I mean, statistically, that's not true. Statistically, we would be the ones just gawking at this spectacle. And maybe, as Jesus breathed his last, maybe we would have said, man, that was wrong. But that's it. The real power in these moments and in these narratives, these histories, these stories, whatever word you want to use, is that eventually, if we sit with them long enough, they will form into a mirror that allows us to examine ourselves. And it takes a lot of courage to be able to see the ugliness that looks back at you. It takes courage to think about, well, have I ever gotten caught up in those pile-on moments, those moments where rather than acknowledge the human being in front of me, I could be popular if I made jokes at their expense or let fly with the latest gossip that I've got or just make fun of them anyway or just be cruel or exclude just because I don't like them, but I know that if I do that, then they will like me, and that's what I ultimately want. Human beings do this. This is just one of our things. And that's a really scary thought. That if we want to put ourselves in that moment, that's where it would probably be. One of the first things he said, at least in this section, was, Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. There's a contrast there that we probably don't notice. In the stories that Jesus would have heard and his disciples would have heard as they grew up, just like my dad would tell me the stories of the Alamo and, you know, all kinds of other Wild Westy kinds of stories. So maybe it's no surprise that they're moving to Durango to live out his childhood fantasy, I guess. But the stories that they would have been the stories of the Maccabees, the Hasmonean revolutionaries who fought off the Greeks successfully for a little while, enough to form a kind of a dynasty. And in those stories, there are some martyrs who are being tortured to death and killed by the Greeks. And those, I think, we should always read next to what Jesus is experiencing here. Because they, as they are dying, call down horrific curses on their torturers. They implore the God of the universe, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, to destroy these people. But Jesus simply says, Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. And if what I've said is right, that it's more likely than not that if we were there watching this happen, we were on our way to wherever we were going to celebrate Passover, we stop and gawk and wow, look at that, that's crazy, and just join in the spectacle. Jesus' words still apply to us. Like the fact that we're all human and we've all bought into this at some point doesn't put any distance between us and the forgiveness and grace that Jesus is winning for us in that moment. In fact, if anything, the fact that we've engaged in that same behavior, and who knows what we would have done in that moment, maybe that makes the forgiveness that Jesus wins all the more real. Makes it all the more unconditional. Makes it all the more generous. And that's at least one of the many layers of things that happens in that moment at the place of the skull. That is infinite grace. Amen. Please rise as you are able.